Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for joining me. Today my guest is Yondela Silimela. She's a town and regional planner by training. Today she works as a consultant across the subcontinent. She has a particular interest in cities, city governments, and the built environment. She has previously worked at the City of Johannesburg, where she was head of development planning, and at the Public Investment Corporation, where she worked in property investment. We spoke about how she ended up quite fortuitously studying town planning. This was at M.L. Sultan College in Durban many, many years ago. And while the discussion focused on issues around policies and politics of access to property, transport, and employment in Johannesburg, I think the discussion is relevant to urban centers across South Africa. We also discussed the role of government as a property regulator and property provider. We also looked at the impact of inclusionary housing policy here in Johannesburg and the role of property developers, that's private property developers, in resolving the housing crisis in the city. Please now enjoy my chat with Yondela. All right, Yondela, thanks very much for your time this morning. Pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
You are a development planner. Is that a correct way of describing yourself, development planner?
I suppose it is. It is evolving. So development planning is at the core of it. But recently, I have an interest in cities and multiple facets of cities, so city governance being a part of it, mm-hmm. the built environment being a part of it, and municipal finances. But yeah, development planner is a nice catch-all.
But you're trained as an urban, what did you?
A town and regional
planner. Town and regional planner,
yes. A Stad en Streeksbeplanner.
Okay. Where did you do that? Where did you study that?
My first qualification was with M.L. Sultan Technikon in KZN.
Okay, all right.
It's now DUT.
Yes, part yeah. incorporated into yeah. DUT. Okay. So, when was that, if I may ask?
That would have been 1992 until 1994, I think.
Okay. So that was when it was still M.L. Sultan, then the sort of just pre-independence, as it yeah. were, kind of yeah. education structures, right? Yeah. Urban and regional planner, yes. But those are all interesting, you were talking about there in your role as development planner, interesting areas, quite multifaceted then, components to urban development and sort of the changing nature of cities, mm-hmm. I suppose, if we could call it that, right? Mm. And in the context of a seemingly unstoppable trend to urbanization that has been going on in this country for the last 50 years, but I suppose increased now dramatically over the last 25 with the breakdown of those apartheid urban laws.
Yeah. I think of myself as a development activist. The built environment is the area where I'm trained, and cities just happen to be where I practice and have a particular area of interest, but development more broadly. So my interest isn't in kind of just hardcore town planning or urban planning, but it's in how the physical environment is manipulated to create a more just and equal society. That's the kind of driving force for me. So you talk about urbanization, in particular post 94. I was born in the Transkei.
In the homeland,
former TBVS estate.
Mm. And part of that apartheid then, planning.
Total
which
kind
is
of
the antithesis of what you...
Of what I do now, right? Yeah. The thing that was interesting about that is that on a national scale, these kind of deconcentration states that were defined along tribal lines, within those states, there was actually very little racial segregation. So in Transkei, where I grew up, my neighbors were white Transkeians, I guess, the Coopers. So in that little enclave, life was very different to what life was, I suppose, in the rest of South Africa.
Strange.
So it was a shock to the system for me when I first came to Joburg and I started working. and I went into and how stark the segregation was. Because I grew up in a slightly different, and I shouldn't romanticize it too much, because there were townships even then that were predominantly black, but you could live in suburban
wherever Mthatha, you wanted, if you could afford
it. Yeah. The schools, Mthatha High School was a Model C school, and there were black kids at the school. So yeah, so
kind of weird, kind of interesting paradox. Hey?
Yeah.
When the whole process was to segregate, and at the same time, there's a weird sort of bubble in those homelands. Maybe let's just go back a little bit then to your childhood. You were born in Mthatha itself.
I was born. No, actually. So at the time when my mother was having me, she went to my aunt, who was in Tsolo. So I was born in a rural village called St. Cuthbert's Mission.
Yeah, that's still in the Transkei, but sort of rural then.
Yeah,
rural Transkei. Yeah.
So my aunt is still there. So when I go home, I still.
That's where you go.
Yeah.
And your parents then? What were they doing, or what was your?
So my my mother was a PA at the TDC, Transkei Development Corporation.
Okay.
I think the function where she was a PA to the company secretary. My dad was a radio man, so my dad is a DJ.
Get out.
Promise you. My dad was a DJ, and he was with then Radio Bantu, Radio Xhosa, which subsequently became Umhlobo Wenene.
So you came from, I suppose, in the context of this homeland system of apartheid South Africa, you come from a sort of quite professional home then, petit bourgeois, would you say, almost like
middle
sort
class.
Of aspiring middle class home. So I'm reluctant to use the word privileged, but comfortable in that context, and your parents are able to send you to... sort of better schools, I suppose, than were perhaps available to most South Africans at the time.
Mm-hmm. Or Transkeians is the case.
Or Transkeians at that time. What were your sort of thoughts and dreams at school? Was urban planning somehow always part of your thinking, or how did you?
Gosh, no. I mean, probably until very late in high school, I didn't even know of this thing called town planning. So I was fairly good in maths and science, and you know, when you're growing up and everyone says you're going to be a doctor, so that was my thing, that I was going to be a doctor.
Right.
And in high school, I think standard 9, grade 11, my desk mate had a stroke, or her nerve collapsed. And so I used to go with
her. In class?
I don't know if it was in class.
But she suffered a
severe... But she suffered, a neurological...
Bloody hell.
And so post the kind of medical care, she used to go to physio after school. So I used to go with her to physio.
Oh.
And so I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to be physiotherapist. So this is grade 11 into grade 12. Like, yeah. I want to be a physiotherapist. At the same time, my sister, who was my elder sister, my only sister actually, I think she was studying social work at the time at University of Westville.
UDW.
And she kind of mentioned town planning. So at some point she wanted to do this thing called town planning, but that was the first I'd heard of it, and I had no inkling of what this thing was. So anyway, so I finished matric, and I didn't get, my grades were not as good as I had thought they were. So kind of boys got into the picture, and being a teenager got into. Yeah, I know. And that interfered with my results.
Mm.
I took a gap year. I taught preschool for a year.
Oh wow.
At the university. So my former high school teacher had just started a preschool, Mrs. Underhill.
Okay.
And I joined her for a year because I was trying, I was very disappointed with myself and how I did with my matric, and I was trying to figure out my next step. And so the year after that gap year, my mother was like, okay, so enough faffing around, you're going to have to get back to, get back on the horse now. And off I went to Durbs. And I think we went to Natal Tech, and we went to ML Sultan.
Just sort of looking for something that would spark your interest.
I had applied for to get into one of the medical kind of
streams.
I think it was dental technology or something. And when we got to ML, there was this new course that had just started, town and regional planning. So went up the stairs to the seventh floor, signed up, completed application forms. And you was, I think we went back a day or so later, and there was a list of names of people who had been accepted. And that's how I got into town planning.
Man.
Total fluke, in that sense.
And then it obviously, the bug bit somehow. What sort of what sort of kept you on the on that path? I mean, what was there sort of a light bulb moment when you realized what the potential of this training might be, or was it just, you just kept on at it?
Well, I mean, I suppose in one breath, it's not like I had the option of changing course. I mean, I had a, I think I had a bursary in year two, in year one, my mother's, by the way, I come from broke, split families. My mom and dad were not together.
Oh, I see.
So my mom was putting us through school.
Uh-huh.
So you didn't, or at least I didn't have the option of changing course midstream and all
right.
Those courses.
Okay, yeah, you were in, you had to kind of.
You will finish, and you can decide then on your own.
Okay,
now
I understand. Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
So I think that was the one reality
driver. Yeah,
and the second year of the course, you needed to do a year's in service training, and I lived next door to a town planning firm in Umtata. So okay. When I went back for holidays, I literally just went across over the fence and asked them if I could do my in-service training with them. And thankfully for me, they said yes. So I think in the year of in-service training, I had a better sense of what it was about.
Yeah.
Sort
of more practical, hands-on, less theoretical, more kind of this is what we do here.
Yeah. And at the time, the company was working on the RDP Reconstruction and Development Program. And the precursor to the RDP and the what we call RDP now was people were referring to it as toilets in the felt. So it was running a site and service program, kind of the building blocks of the housing subsidy program that we have. And I spent, I think, a week at a time or 2 weeks at a time living in a caravan in Mount Fletcher.
Wow.
In deep rural Transkei.
Yeah, Mount Fletcher. I think I've driven through or past Mount Fletcher.
And working on kind of doing community surveys, working with traditional authorities to identify land.
Mm.
I wasn't leading this, not by a long shot. I work with a lady called Nikki Newton. And I was a skivvy.
The appy.
Yeah, yeah. And that was my first sense
taking
of
notes and
taking, yeah. And converting these handwritten notes into typed up records.
Reports and that.
That's
also, I mean, given that you're sort of very much focused on cities now, it's kind of you've come the whole, if that was the start of your journey, because, I mean, that is, especially rural South Africa, seems to have been almost forgotten in many respects when it comes to the planning environment, or is that an incorrect assessment?
I don't know if it is forgotten, because I think in the South African sense at least there's still this kind of tension and consciousness of the kind of rural-urban divide.
Hmm.
Even if you look at our National Urban Development Framework, the IUDF, it still talks about the rural-urban linkage. So certainly from a national policy stance, as consciousness of the role of rural in the interrelations between the two, I do think that rural areas have suffered the hollowing out of capacity. So a lot of people have moved from those areas. So it looks like it's forgotten in part because the skill isn't there and it's difficult to get practitioners to stay in those areas. So if you're able to ply your trade in Durbs or Cape Town or Joburg, why the hell would you be based in Mount Fletcher? So, yeah.
And I think that's not a unique South African problem, is it, either? I mean, I know in Sweden, for example, there are many villages that are being emptied of people.
Yeah.
And I think in Italy as well, I was reading, I mean, there's villages now selling homes for £1 each, you know, just to try and
get them
attract
occupied.
People to prevent them from being emptied. I think, obviously, maybe we can touch on this now, given what you were saying right at the beginning when we started about sort of breaking down barriers and making the urban environment a safe and equitable space for everyone. Mm. That is, I suppose, I mean, I don't like to harp on about legacies of apartheid, but you would say that is probably the most obvious physical legacy of apartheid, is the still these racially divided cities that we have. And what do you see then as the possibilities of making our cities more integrated, both at a class and race level, I suppose?
So if you think about how deliberate apartheid planning was, right? So there was a very clear policy layer. There was a clear infrastructure investment logic to it. And the administration. So that it wasn't a fluke. So for us to undo that, we need to be as deliberate. And I do think that post-94, we've kind of tinkered at the edges of confronting that reality. So look at it this way. When it comes to employment, we've had BEE, so employers know you need your labor force must reflect the demographics and those kind of things. And we haven't done that in the physical environment. And yet the physical environment was defined by the same rules that excluded a certain profile from employment or education. And since 94, what we've tried to do is to get jobs into this dormitory, into this poor black dormitory areas. And we know that hasn't been successful. So we need to be deliberate in taking these people into the parts of the city that are well endowed with social infrastructure, engineering infrastructure, and employment. So we need a BEE equivalent for the physical environment. Mm. Because taking jobs to where people are, so it was a classic example. It's taken however many years to get at least the investment in retail. But you're not seeing the investment in commercial office, for instance, because the location just doesn't have the ingredients. But there's no reason why Kilani doesn't have a racial and class profile that reflects the demographic profile of the city. So, yeah, so we need to shift the dial, I think, in how we intervene and sharpen the instruments that we use.
And so is that government that does that, or what is how do you see then the sort of future? Because I mean, I wrote here affordable housing versus profitable housing, and sort of that'll take you into discussion about, like, who's building the houses. Is it government that buys land, builds houses, and dedicates that housing scheme, project, whatever it is, to a particular
end user?
A particular end user, particularly a low-income end user, but in an, as you say, a sort of more accessible, because there's that balance between then location and transport and employment. I mean, all of these things are all in the mix, right?
Yeah.
Is it for government to just create the policy framework in which the private property developers operate? Is it more integrated in terms of a partnership between government and property developers, or is it property developers alone? I mean, or do you see it as a complete mix of all of the above?
So that whenever those questions are asked, the easiest one is the mix. But in the
You a gap.
Thank you so much. In the South African context, government plays a role of both policy or regulator, policy setter and regulator, as well as provider of housing opportunities. So it stands to reason then that if we're driving towards these inclusive residential areas or these inclusive areas, the state has to provide for that in the regulatory instruments and similarly in the investment decisions that it makes. So let's take the regulatory instruments. Joburg is approving, I think, now in February or imminently, the inclusionary housing policy, which is effectively an inclusionary zoning instrument that says that if you're building X number of residential units, X percentage of them have to be targeted at this income band. Mm. And that's based on the recognition that a significant proportion of the housing stock that's coming onto the market is by the private sector. And unless there's a level of affordable housing stock that's part of that, the demand is going to keep the demand for housing, affordable housing, is going to keep getting bigger. So you need to marshal the energies and resources of the private sector to respond to this demand as well. And if you move to the role of government as a provider of housing stock, what has happened previously, and I suppose because of the housing regime, is that a lot of the affordable housing stock, when I use affordable loosely to mean from RDP to the so-called gap market, a lot of that stock has been provided in less than ideal locations because land was cheap and you could get scale. So
it hasn't really resolved many of the issues then we're talking about, because people are still living far away from employment.
Yeah. So it's resolved the shelter issue, but it hasn't made a fundamental shift or dent in creating housing assets that perform optimally as economic assets as well. So you have a house, but the location is bad relative to employment. So in the lower end of the market, I think at some point the statistics in Johannesburg is at the lower end of the of residents were spending between 50% and 70% of their incomes on food and transport.
Is it that much? I've always sort of had a thumb suck at it, but wow.
So it's insane, right?
Jeepers.
It's totally unsustainable.
I would have thought, I mean, as I say, a thumb suck would have been 30 to 35, but that kind of also does make sense. I mean, the other thing is that a lot of people are still walking, aren't they? And that is another strain on the human condition if you're having to walk to and from work every day.
So walking in and off itself is actually ideal. So if you look at many cities in the world, they're trying to increase the proportion of trips that are so-called non-motorized transport, so walking, cycling. The issue is what distances and what's that environment like.
Exactly. It's kind of stressful, not safe perhaps.
So there isn't,
and it's a long distance.
And the distances are...
It's not a calm, relaxed walk to work is what I'm saying. It's kind of hours to and from.
Yeah. So that's the issue. But I mean, if you look at places like Alexandra, for instance, a few years back, the city kind of did a count between Alex and Sandton over Grayston Bridge, 10,000 people per hour at peak.
Whoa.
But that distance is doable because Alex is not that far from Sandton. But there are very few places where that home and work proximity works for pedestrian trips.
Yeah.
So walking in and off itself is not a problem. Like I said, I mean, if you look at cities like
it's
London...
It's an aspiration for many modern cities in a way.
Multiple benefits, less emissions, it's healthier, and you don't deal with... It takes away the congestion. The issue for us are the distances and that whether you've got sufficient infrastructure that makes for comfortable walking. So people are not having to kind of navigate space with cars. There's clear infrastructure that's set aside for that.
Yeah.
Which is why this kind of the idea of a compact city where people don't live too far from work works, in that becomes a doable thing, right? So it's a 20-minute walk, it's a 30-minute walk to get to where you're going to, and that's okay.
That leads us then to this whole, I suppose... Well, it would require a shift, really, in how housing is, or what kind of housing is built in the city, because we seem to be, I'm not sure if it's just a historical thing, but there's certainly more cachet, more credence, more kudos, whatever, given to owning your own home as opposed to living in an apartment block. That's the sort of impression I get. Mm-hmm. We don't seem to, when we think of housing, think in terms of more high-density solutions, particularly in urban centres like Johannesburg. Why is that, and how do we sort of shift that thinking?
So firstly, I think we must create a distinction between ownership and rental, so tenure types versus the configuration of the home, right? There is still a great deal of emphasis on ownership, which is maybe not such a bad thing, because then it's an asset and we have an entire mortgage, a whole financial system that's geared for this. The issue, I think, is choice. So for those people who cannot afford to buy, do they have sufficient access to rental stock? And that's a 10-year discussion. But I think where you're going to is the configuration of the space. So, I mean, if you think about it, Joburg is not a city. It's not an urban city. It's a suburban city, because you still do have single dwelling units. The kind of dominant housing typology in Joburg is single dwelling units. We all want a little acre of Africa. You want your own private tennis court and your private swimming pool. But it's a city that's transitioning. Certainly, if you look at city policies, they're supporting multiple family dwelling units. And I think you will see a lot more multiple apartment-style living. One, because land is becoming more expensive. It's coming in at a premium. And also, we need much higher densities to make things like public transport work. Mm-hmm. So Joburg is currently averaging, I think, 3,000 people per square kilometre.
Yeah.
So UN Habitat says that for sustainable neighborhoods, you need to get to about 15,000 people per square kilometer.
Whoa.
So we're still quite a ways away from where we ought to be. The issue with our density is how it's organized. So places like, I would say, probably Bryanston are probably 50 units per hectare. Alex? Let's talk people. So probably 50 or 60 or 90 per square kilometer. Places like Alex, I had 42,000 people per square kilometer.
Okay, so that density figure is kind of a bit of an anomalous.
So if you average it, hide a multitude of sins.
Yeah.
And the issue for us is that our highest population densities are in the parts of the city that are least resourced. Physical environment, employment, social infrastructure.
So the townships still, the older townships, basically. Yeah.
So you need to smooth that density spread out a lot more. And the way around that is to get a lot more people living in the parts of the city that are well-resourced, that have a greater job density.
Mm. There seems to be massive challenges, as you say, the apartheid system was so kind of geared, structured, focused. It had all sort of levels of government focused on one project, as it were.
Yeah.
And to undo that is perhaps maybe impossible, but can be mitigated through various efforts. You spoke about the sort of regulatory, almost like a BEE for property solution. I was just wondered if you could maybe just unpack that a little bit more,
sure.
how that would work, because automatically, you know, we've discussed that issue of sort of private property developers being kind of compelled to provide 20% low income or rental housing or anything like
affordable housing.
But I mean, I imagine that they're not happy with that. And that would just be one component of this kind of breakdown because, as you say, we mentioned transport, security.
Mm.
So it's not just a matter of sort of building houses in certain areas and hoping that, you know, you build it and they will come kind of thing. There's all kinds of other things that have to happen, right?
Sure. So let's deal with this inclusionary zoning instrument. I think it's fair to say that there's been mixed reaction. There are some developers actually who haven't resisted, who've actually actively worked with the city in refining how the instrument would work. There are some who've expressed negative sentiments. And this, the city has been working on this, I think, for a good 2 years before this point. So it's kind of gone through.
Right.
And there will be many other iterations and refinement of how this would work. There are a couple of things. One is that is how you define affordable. So one of what the city has said is that social housing is deemed as being affordable. And social housing is interesting because there is actually a grant that's targeted for social housing. So I think as much as 65% of what it takes to bring that unit onto the market is subsidized.
Oh, wow.
So it is possible from a funding or financial feasibility to make these schemes work if you're a social housing agency and you qualify for the grant and you maintain the rental stock as per the social housing regulatory authority's requirements. But there are also other incentives that the city is looking at. So it's looking at increasing density. So, I mean, there's a certain point at which additional bulk that you don't pay for, you can then use to provide affordable housing stock. There are concessions that are being considered around paying bulk contributions. So there are multiple incentive points in the development process that developers can engage with the city on to see what it takes to make the schemes workable. Mm. There are certain areas where it's very difficult to make them work, but there are other areas where it's a lot easier to make them work. And I think, like I said, the instrument itself will be refined over time.
Right.
So the discussion...
It'll evolve.
It will evolve. So the engagement with the developers is one part of what this thing tries to do.
Right.
There's another almost stumbling block, and that relates to how current residents view these inclusionary developments and the objections that the city receives when there's an application for high-density use.
Hmm.
And often residents will object to high density and because high density is proxy for mixed income.
Hmm.
And how we navigate those things in the conversations we have as Joburgers or a society around what exactly is our reluctance to inclusionary living? Why is it a problem? So in one area where when I was still in the city that we dealt with, the NIMBY concern was wrapped up nicely in the aren't sufficient schools, for instance, the aren't sufficient public schools, so where are these children going to go to school? So if you solve for public schools in these areas, does that take the problem away?
Hmm.
But then the Residents Association, yeah, but the schools must be built ahead of demand. But that doesn't happen anyway. So often these schools respond to express demand.
Environment, yeah.
So they're interesting conversations that we need to have So when you're no longer
citizens,
what exactly am I uncomfortable with,
mm.
and how do we mitigate the thing that I'm uncomfortable with?
Yeah,
you know, so
it's kind of almost have that conversation in my head sometimes myself. You know, I spoke to Ruth Hall down at Western Cape. You know, talking to her more about land. But as I said when I first spoke to you, she was one of the first people who kind of, you know, made me think about urban land as well.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the things was, well, maybe we do have to get rid of a couple of golf courses. And I was thinking, okay, so now what now if Killarney Country Club now becomes, you know, a sort of low-rise or high-rise housing development here for low to medium income people? Now, how would I think about that?
Mm.
And, you know, on the one level, I'm Yeah. Okay. Let's see where that goes.
Yeah.
I think I kind of say that with the in the knowledge that, you know, I'll still be quite sheltered here in my little Killarney suburb, so I can sort of afford to say that.
But what if it was a block across the road?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, those are things that, if you have that kind of egalitarian mindset, which I do have, then I have to accept that as part of the process of building a new South Africa in some kind of weird way, I suppose. But it is fascinating that, you know, urban land, and maybe we can just talk about that now, has not really been part of this sort of land discussion to the extent that rural or agricultural land has been part of that discussion. I suppose because rural land is so obviously sort of white-owned, or, you know, the agricultural sector is sort of still very sort of white-dominated, and I think there's obvious sort of questions about how we're transforming those sectors as much as giving people property rights or land rights in rural areas. But urban land, now, one of the things Ruth Hall said to me was, for example, where people are living in informal settlements in a city, they should just be given that land. How does that translate to people who are, say, squatting in an apartment block in downtown Johannesburg, where the sort of DA government has been making very sort of overt efforts to evict people from those properties?
So, I mean, urban land, so interestingly, I wrote into the Dear South Africa when the Section 25 changes initially came out, and then my particular interest was on urban land. And I think, again, when we talk about urban land, we must separate ownership, so tenure, versus land use rights, so what you can do with the land. So let's start with land use rights. Up until very recently, Joburg was operating 16 town planning schemes. And this is the process through which the city determines what you can and cannot do on your land. And this is obviously a historical legacy. So there were parts of the city where on your house, a second dwelling unit was a standard, it's a primary right. So you have the right to your main house and a second dwelling unit, and you can use either as a servant's quarters or as a granny flat. There are parts of the city where you needed to come and ask the city for permission to have a second dwelling unit. And those inequalities are part of what plays, and that's not an ownership issue, that's a land use, that's what you can do with your land. There are parts of the city where a home industry is by consent, or historically you can, by consent from the city, you can run your practice from home. There are parts of the city where you can't do that by consent, you have to rezone your property. So the regulatory hurdle that you have to clear to ply your trade from home is much higher. And these are things that make urban land different from rural land. It's what you can do with the land. It's what densities you can achieve and what infrastructure supports those densities. And I think it's a long before we talk about whether those informal settlements should be legalized, even in the areas that are legal, where occupancy is legal, the limitations on what people are able to do on their land is a huge deal. Let's take backyard rental units for a minute. So if you take a place like Diepsloot, formal township, started out with a main house RDP unit. People over time have built 6-8 rental rooms on the back of that. All of that is illegal. And yet there's clearly demand, there's clearly housing demand that's met by that market. What does the state do? Do you make those people rezone so that you can bring those backyard rental units into some kind of regulatory
structured,
right? So that they can borrow from banks and blah, 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 blah. Or do you run a process of regularizing that? So give them, they don't have to apply, grant them the zoning, get a process through which they submit building plans, you can approve building plans, and once you've got approved building plans, you can use that to borrow, you know? So you open up a whole new market just by how you view the regulatory authority of the state. And these are things that I think that the urban land discussion needs to deal with. I mean, there was a time when we were talking about, so typically when the municipality is considering land use rights, it looks at the location, it does not look at who the applicant is. Mm-hmm. At some point people are saying, but surely black people should have higher bulk just to balance the scales, but that would create in a disorderly city. So you would have areas just because black people own, suddenly the densities would be much higher, but that might not necessarily be the location where those densities should be carried. So I mean, that they're all interesting variations of how you deal with land use rights, and I think that that's a conversation that we ought to be having in the urban context. Now to ownership. I think that it would be reckless to transfer tenure to informal settlements without taking into account whether the location of those informal settlements relative to, I mean, there are geotechnical considerations, for instance. Some are located on dolomite. So if you transfer tenure, there's a limitation on what people can do with that land because just geotechnically it cannot handle.
It's not built for anything really.
Right? Or the location is so bad relative to employment. And it's going to take forever to get decent public transportation into those areas. And it's a tricky determination to make. So you don't transfer tenure in anticipation that those people will move, but they don't have the means to move, and the state takes 20 years before it creates an alternative. So they sit in this no man's land for 20, 30 years. But I do think, so the point I'm trying to make is that it can be a universal transfer of tenure just because people have been, there's some kind of basic checks that need to be undertaken. Yeah.
Yeah, you're sort of touching on, I suppose, I'm not sure how to assess it, but you know, so many promises have been made by the government, particularly in the early years of the post-apartheid era around housing and how many houses were going to be built, and clearly that those targets or figures have never really been achieved. Is there any sense that we will, and again, this is not a uniquely South African problem, it's not even an African problem or a global South problem, it's a problem of cities, I think, all around the world, the lack of urban housing. And how do you get ahead of that demand?
So given
our sort of specific unique urban planned history.
Yeah. I mean, at the heart of it is an economy that's performing suboptimally. For as long as that's prevailing, demand will always outstrip supply. Because if the economy was performing, you would have less people reliant on the state for housing provision. But also the state, if the economy was performing well, the state would be making more money from taxes and therefore able to build
more houses.
Yeah. So for me, the biggest thing that we need to get right is the economy and have a lot more people participating in the economy, a lot more people in employment, or if they are entrepreneurs, the limitations or the hurdles to that entrepreneurship being removed. So that's the one thing. The other thing that we need to do, I think, is we need to rethink our housing subsidy regime. So we currently subsidize the supply side. So developers receive the subsidy, they build on behalf of an end user. And we need to think of perhaps a mix of both supply side intervention, but also demand side intervention.
You mean sort of providing low interest loans for first time buyers, or
precisely
some kind of support for people who want to buy their own home,
or rent, or rental, right?
Okay.
So we need greater flexibility in how the fiscal instruments are designed. Then the third thing is we need to look at easing self provision. I mean, I spoke earlier on.
What do you mean by that self-provision?
I spoke earlier about the backyard rental units.
Oh, okay.
That's an emergent sector of real estate. It's informal, it's unplanned, unregulated, but it is meeting demand. So we need to carefully think about what instruments we deploy to make that work better. So whether it is regularizing the zoning, supporting people, the landlords to build better shelter.
Infrastructure like water and electricity.
Yeah, because then, yeah, I mean, that market is a lot more flexible. I mean, my brother lived in a back room in Diepsloot that was probably 9 square meters. All he needed was a bed, and that worked okay for him. But you will not get any state-provided shelter that provides that configuration, you know? I think we need to tackle this on multiple fronts. There isn't a single front. So the inclusionary zoning instrument that looks at how the private sector provides affordable housing stock is one. The state's housing subsidy regime is another. Self-build or people's housing process, or whatever one calls it, is another. So there are multiple entry points that we need to explore in enabling greater stock to come onto the market at the right price point for what people can afford in decent locations.
And where are we on in that discussion? Would you say, in your experience of dealing with governments and developers and communities?
I do think that there's something happening in all of those. There perhaps just not sufficient emphasis. So Trust for Urban Housing Finance, TUF, has an interesting program called Umastand, a funding program called Umastand. Umastand is a term that's used for a landlord that looks at making end-user finance available to those landlords to upgrade their backyard rental units. But I don't know that it's receiving the right kind of support from municipalities to regularize those environments so that these can be units that are built with approved building plans. So there's stuff happening in all of this, but not at the right scale, I think, for them to kind of deliver the potential that they can. So even with inclusionary zoning, Joburg, as far as I know, is the most advanced. I know Mangaung has something in their policy, but you don't have the cities driving this inclusionary zoning instrument at the right kind of scale to have the impact that it can. There are discussions around reconfiguring the housing subsidy program, but I don't know that that is moving at the kind of pace that it should.
I just want to speak a little bit about where you are now. You've worked recently in the city of Johannesburg as a development planner, and before that, as I understand, with the Public Investment Corporation, also in the sort of housing development.
Real estate development.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what are you doing now?
I'm consulting. I've got a one-woman consulting company. And I've been doing work with multinationals. I'm doing some work in Nairobi. I'm doing work in Kigali.
I've been there, yeah.
Yeah, so Ditomboweni and I are mates. We all think Kigali. No, I'm kidding.
Cleanest city in Africa.
And I've been working with some real estate funds and developers in Johannesburg. And not just in residentials. I mean, one of my clients is owns retail assets in Johannesburg. So, yeah.
What would your sort of perfect world look like for Johannesburg in, say, 10 to 20 years? Let's be a little bit more realistic then, because 5 years is... I mean, if you could wave a magic wand, if I could put it like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the one thing that I would do is to find a mechanism through which political parties that contest elections in Johannesburg sign into some kind of social compact on certain investments that have to be made that go over political cycles.
So you wouldn't have, you set up a more consistent policy if given, even if there's a change of government, as it were, at the local level.
Yeah.
There'd be some sort of policy continuity.
And investment continuity. Because if you're rolling out BRT, it doesn't help if you start with phase 1C and while you're busy with construction, there's an election and then there's a rethink of whether or not this ought to be running here. You've kind of gone too far down the line to pull back. But those kind of decisions should not be made just by the ruling party. At that point, they should be made by all parties who are part of council and some, like I said, some multi-political cycle commitment. Similarly, with investment in bulk water supply or in bulk infrastructure, in bulk electricity, this kind of multi-year big ticket items, some commitment on those investments, but also specifically where those investments are going to be in the city, because that's part of what sends the signal to the private sector on where to put their money.
Mm.
Yeah. So for me, that would be a big win. So that even when there are changes, there's an operating core, a policy in infrastructure investment and operating core that kind of stays constant.
Yondela, let's leave it there. Thanks so much for your time this morning. It was lovely to meet you.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. I think it's not as scary as I thought.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I found it fascinating. Really touching on issues, I suppose, you don't really, or at least I don't, think too deeply about on a day-to-day basis. I was intrigued by her suggestion of a BEE-style intervention, or dramatic intervention, I suppose you'd say, into housing policy, sort of echoing what Lulu Gwagwa had said in an interview or discussion I had with her earlier last year, sort of trying to dismantle the firm hold that apartheid spatial planning still has on our cities. And also the idea that city governments, municipal governments in large cities should agree a long-term housing policy that would outlive at least changes in government, so you have some kind of continuity in urban planning and housing development. Please subscribe to Voices from SA and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.